Welcome to the scorching arena of valor and the crucible of courage. This is the Forged in the Fires podcast with Fireman Rob. Here in the inferno of life's greatest challenges, heroes are shaped and legends are born. Every episode is a torchlight of wisdom, casting a glow on the paths walked by those who've braved the flames and emerged stronger. In this furnace of fortitude, we'll explore tales of resilience, bravery, and the unyielding human spirit. Each guest brings their own spark of insight, lighting up the darkness and guiding us through the smoke of adversity. With Fireman Rob at the helm, prepared to delve into conversations that smolder with significance and stories that kindle the soul. It's not just a podcast, it's a beacon for all who seek to rise from the ashes and glow with purpose. So stoke the fires of your curiosity and ready your heart for tales of triumph and transformation. The flames are roaring. The stage is ablaze. Welcome to the Forged in the Fires podcast. Let the journey begin.
All right, welcome back to Forged in the Fires podcast. I'm your host, Fireman Rob. Today's guest, he evokes emotion in people. He has done amazing things, working as a paramedic, as a pre-hospital educator, retired firefighter, and he has amazing art. He is one of the most amazing people. Let's just get into this. Daniel Sandahl, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great. Thanks, Rob. I'm happy to be here.
You know, we were talking about this before, and I want people to make sure you go to dansunphotos.com. You're going to see some amazing things. I want to actually go back before we start talking about the photos, because you've had an amazing life of many different things that you've done, and being a global, having global residency was pretty cool too as well. But I want to go back to when you started in the fire service. How did you come about wanting to do that?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. I realized I wanted to become a paramedic.
Yeah.
I was living in the Cayman Islands, training to become a dive master. I know, it was fantastic. And part of the dive master training was learning to be a rescue diver. So that was my first introduction to CPR and, first aid and rescuing people from water. And that was my first intro to that. And I loved it. It was super exciting. And when I was driving home from class, I saw this guy get smoked by this huge dump truck on the road.
Oh, geez.
And I got so excited. And I pulled over and I'm like, oh, I'm going to save this guy. And I ran up there and he was like folded in half and his foot was up by his face. And I'm like, oh my God, what do I do? I had no idea. Yeah. Like, I can't, how do I do chest compressions? This is like femurs across his chest. Like, what do I do? I didn't want to move him. And then the paramedic showed up, unfolded him and put him in the ambulance and drove away. I'm like, that is great.
I love this.
I love this, right? Which is kind of, you know, for people that don't get it, you know, that's really weird. It's like when, you know, what's your best call? Like, what's a good call?
Yeah.
Our definitions of good calls are people's, you know, worst days, but that's just because we get to practice the skills that we've learned, right? But
exactly.
That's kind of when I realized, yeah, maybe my mind is maybe a bit twisted enough that I should be a paramedic. Like, why am I so excited about this? So that's kind of the genesis of it. And then I did a lot of things in between that time. I worked as an English teacher, several different countries, and then decided, okay, I'm going to fulfill this dream of being a paramedic. And part of, once I became a paramedic, the full-time position that I took was at a fire department. Yeah. And they were transitioning to a volunteer fire department to a composite. And they were hiring paramedics, full-time paramedics, to train them to become firefighters. And that's kind of what I did. And I loved it. I did that for 20 years. And I retired from that position just a couple of years ago.
That's awesome. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
That's where I'm hoping to get to soon.
Yeah, I think it's
a good day.
It was good because we were integrated and we did 24-hour shifts. So I would work 24 hours on the ambulance and I'll be off for 24. Then I'll work 24 hours on the engine and then I'll be off for 5 days. It was a great schedule.
Oh, wow.
I think that's because amazing. It was so we did, it was so dynamic that I think that really was a big part of my longevity. Instead of just doing straight EMS, I think the reason I lasted 20 years, which, you know, there's a lot of men and women out there that have been doing it for way longer than that, 20, 30, 40. The other day I met someone that was doing it for 50 years and that's great. But, I don't think in my area where I live, I don't think I would have lasted. I think would have been burned out pretty quick because we're quite busy. And, so I really like that model. I loved it.
I love how you're talking about, and this kind of gets great into your artwork is you started creating this artwork. What was your first one that you created, the artistic, photo that you created, emulating kind of your thoughts? Cause you've said these are kind of your thoughts put onto paper.
Yeah. That one was back in 2014. And the reason I created that was actually part of my therapy. That's when I was first diagnosed with PTSD. Okay. And my therapist at the time was thinking of ways that I could process these traumatic memories that I was having and how it was affecting me. And he said, Dan, and he knew that I was doing photography, pictures of landscaping and my dogs and that kind of stuff. And he thought, well, maybe you can try processing these by creating artwork from it. Right. And I thought, that's a horrible idea. I don't want to get into it. Like, I don't want to, I don't want to think about it. I came here to forget about this stuff.
Yeah. Like, what are you telling me?
Give me a pill so I can go back to work. Like, I don't want to think about this stuff. And he's like, yeah, Dan, it doesn't work that way. You really have to get into it and file it away and process it properly. I'm like, oh, okay. And he was right. So that was how it all started. And he was absolutely right. He was, I'm in school right now learning to become a counseling therapist. I'm learning about a lot of the neurobiology and what's really happening in the brain during trauma. And as I'm learning all this stuff, I'm like, oh, okay, that's what happened to me. Oh, okay, that's why I happened. That's why I behaved that way. And you know, I'm making all these realizations of what happened to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, by doing that process, I'm recalling that memory while activating a different part of my brain, the frontal cortex, to interrupt what the normal response would be. So when I was done, I could remember that scene, but not have the associated emotions and physical response to it. So he knew what he was doing and it did work. And that was the first images that I did. And I didn't share them for the longest time because they were, you know, showing a paramedic in the back of the ambulance. There's a body underneath a sheet and there's a ghost there. It's really weird. And he's got his gloved hands on his head. He's all upset.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm not going to show this to anybody. Like if my peers see this, just even the people, the guys in my fire department, if they saw it, even though it's a few of them helped me create it, I'm like, God, I'm going to get crucified showing paramedics and firefighters in a vulnerable state like this. So I didn't for the longest time, but I was still creating a lot of artwork because it was very therapeutic for me. I was able to purge these things and these feelings and emotions I was having and trap them in these two-dimensional images. So I kept doing it. And then eventually I thought, you know, as I was starting to feel better, I thought, you know, I'm going to share these just because they're kind of cartoony looking. They're kind of cool looking, just artistic wise, I thought. And totally expecting to get tons of negative feedback from it. Yeah. And the exact opposite happened. What I didn't realize is that many people would look at the images and attach their own experiences to it and use them as a way to process the emotions they were having. I didn't realize that was going to happen because I felt I was really alone and unique in the way that I was experiencing these processes, right? Which is really common.
That's so common. Yeah.
So yeah, it was wonderful that I did. And when I did start sharing them, it literally changed my life.
That's, you know, it's, I love how you said that. And we talked about that of, you know, I've looked at these images and certain days it's harder to look at them and other days it's like, yes, I needed that. You know, what was that feeling like when you started to hear that back from individuals, that your artwork elicited emotion that they needed to have, that they wanted to have?
Yeah, well, it was wonderful because it validated me and the feelings that I was having. So I don't like those images. I don't create for other people. I don't think, what are people going to like? What are people going to, you know, is this going to trigger people? I'm not going to do it. I don't think of that. Because the idea or the purpose of me creating it is to get my own feelings and emotions out of my head. And when I create them, I'm trying to put down my emotions and what I felt about that call
right.
in that artwork versus what I saw. And so it's very personal to me, and I purge it out of my head. And the more I think, because I'm so authentic in doing that, and I don't censor it, thinking, okay, well, what are people going to like? What are people not going to like? What are people going to buy?
Right.
Because it's so authentic, that really connects with other firefighters and paramedics, that they recognize that, okay, this isn't just an artist creating emergency services artwork. This is a guy that's been there. Like, he knows it.
Yeah.
And that really validates me. So when the feedback started coming in and I realized that our peers were connecting to it as well, then that really made me feel great, because that made me feel I wasn't alone in how I was feeling. Yeah. And it really made me feel that there wasn't really maybe something wrong with me, that maybe the emotions and feelings I was having were actually normal. If so many other people are having them, then that really made me feel, great, because I thought the exact opposite was going to happen.
How powerful was it? Like, I love on the site when you go to, you know, dansunphotos.com, you can go on the photos, but then you also tell a story about it.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Each image has a purpose. Like there's a reason why I created it. And the story part is almost more important than, maybe not more important than the image, but it's an integral part of it. So when art books, I just published my fourth art book, the art books have the image, but it also has the write-up that I do, kind of the reason why I created it, the motivation for creating the image. And when I exhibit my artwork, I always have the narratives that go with the art piece. So it's not just the image, it's the reason why I created it. And for me, like, I love art history. I really like learning about, you know, the other artists, and I'm more interested in why they create the artwork that they do versus the end product of the actual artwork. Right. And I find that is a way more interesting story than the actual image that is created. I feel that's just kind of like the tip of the iceberg of, you know, why was this image created? There's a lot more depth to it than the image itself.
I completely agree with you. And, you know, what's interesting to me, and this is a credit to you, of the number of images that you have. And that just correlates to the number of stories, number of incidents that you've been through. And that's probably not all of them.
But no.
This is it's a great realization for people who don't know that there's a multitude of trauma, of different emotions that run through a career. How, you know, when you put these out there, what do you feel about your career and the emotions that you've captured from a few of the calls, but maybe some still ride in your mind?
Yeah, early on in my life, I realized that I want to live a rich and full life. And right. I knew that was going to come from experiences. And that's why I traveled the world and lived at all these different countries, because I really wanted to experience as much as I could. And that was a big reason why I wanted to go into emergency services. And it certainly didn't disappoint. Right. So anyone that is interested in becoming a firefighter, a paramedic, or an ER nurse or doctor or communications or corrections, I'm like, do it. Like, do it. Like, it's more than what you think it's going to be. Right. And in a wonderful way. Right. So I'm not, even though, you know, the career literally almost killed me, I don't really have negative things to say about it, because it gave me way more than what I wanted in the most wonderful way. That's and huge. It's, I think it's great. And yes, the experiences I had kind of snapped my mind a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think at the time I really didn't know what was happening. There wasn't a lot of resources, wasn't a lot of talk about mental health at that time. This is back, the first one I did was almost 10 years ago now, 2014. So at that time, I didn't really talk a lot about mental health. So I didn't really know what was going on. But now I think there's more awareness. There's a lot of more, there's more resources available. There's the signs are more, people know what the signs are.
Right.
And there's ways to maybe build resilience on it, or kind of be more aware of, okay, when these things start to come up, well, then these are the things I have to do. Kind of build up your mental health jump kit in a way.
I love that you put that way, because it's so valuable to have that jump kit of numerous resources, because we don't know what we need when we need it.
Yeah, I do a lecture or workshop on peer support. So I travel and I speak with peer support members. Oh, wow. And I do some things for them, because they got the double whammy stress, because they're working in a profession already, but then they're also helping their peers with the stresses and events that they have. So I do a special thing for them. And we talk about this mental health jump kit of, before you actually need it, you know, what are you going to do? And it's actually, I have them write it out on a notebook. It's like, okay, who is your therapist going to be?
Right.
Find a therapist that is culturally aware before you actually need it. So figure that out beforehand. You know, who's your contact going to be? Who's your trusted buddy that you're going to phone when you need help, and make that agreement with them that, okay, you're on my list. This is if I need you, you're the person I'm going to call, and vice versa. But then also, the agreement also is, if you start recognizing signs, then you need to call me on my shit, right? And that's the agreement that you have before you actually need it. And then what are your coping mechanisms? Like, figure out what they are before you have the traumatic symptoms, which in my case made me impaired, that I wouldn't have, I wouldn't know where to go. Like, when I needed it, I didn't know what to do. I had no idea what to do, who to phone. I didn't know to even contact my EAP program. I didn't know, because I was, my neural pathways, I didn't know. Yeah. I was literally impaired. I thought suicide was the only way out. I thought I'd kill myself and then I'd be okay. Like, that's how impaired I was. So if I had this book that, okay, when I feel like something's going on, this is my mental health jump kit. This is on the phone. This is my therapist. These are my support systems. These are my coping mechanisms. It's already done out there. It's like, you're not, if you go to a patient that's having an asthma attack, that's not the time you're going to put your airway kit together.
Right.
You're going to prepare for it and put it together. So when you need it, you got it.
Yes.
Or it's like, oh, this guy's can't breathe. Oh, what should we put? What do we need? Let's go put all our airway kit together. Yeah, that's not the time.
That's not the time.
So that's something I really push when not only with the peer support workshop that I do, but a lot of that also is self-care, and that's a big part of it as well. And it's really important. It's like your seatbelt too. You put your seatbelt on, but you don't assume you're going to get into an accident every time, but it's just
preparing.
You just do it anyways. We prepare. So it's almost like a mental health seatbelt. Like, what's your mental health seatbelt?
There you go.
Do you even have one?
Right? Exactly. That's so powerful what you're saying, because I think, you know, a lot of times I've been told, like, once you get into that mental health crisis, you think at like an 8-year-old's mentality.
Yeah.
So in other words, if you think about it from a standpoint, I want to have that be my reaction is going to be this, that's going to be in a positive way. And when you look at your photos, and I kind of wanted to, because I've, were there ones that you got done with and you go, okay, this one scares me to put out?
Yeah, I do it. I'm like, people aren't going to understand this one. They're not going to like this one. But you know, the funny thing is that when I do those ones, and I post them, those are the ones that seem to really connect with people. Those are the ones that really, I'll get messages like, oh man, I had no idea that other people felt this way.
Right.
Like, you know, how can you get in my head this way? Because if I'm feeling it, I'm probably not the only person that feels that way. And I've never posted something where someone didn't connect to it in some way, or I received a message of them connecting it in their own experiences. And many times it's completely different than what my motivation is in creating it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. Like, my interpretation, I don't really like to tell people the reasoning why I create, like, my motivation in creating them.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to take that from them, because they may think, well, if you created the image, then, you know, your interpretation and your reason, that's the truth. And what I'm feeling isn't legitimate then. And that's not the case at all. right? If you right. look at the artwork and you're attaching your own experiences and your interpretation of it, that is just as valid as my interpretation in creating it.
That's a powerful statement that you just said of really? Like, because we so many times in the fire service or EMS or police or military, we feel that we're alone. And at the same point, when something like this comes out, like there's one that fear and shame. Holy yeah. cow. That one's a powerful, powerful image. And yeah. your statement of let somebody else be able to take what they can or want to out of that situation. How powerful was that when you felt that in your own mental health journey of feeling like when you said something that somebody wasn't like judging it or somebody wasn't saying, well, you shouldn't really feel that way because nobody else is coming on that one.
Yeah, that's, and unfortunately that, well, the funny thing is that is the idea of what people have. And in, if you think of like group psychology and group dynamics, it's, yeah. it's like, in the fire hall, someone asks, hey, are you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm totally fine. Why are you even asking, right? But yeah. you get that person one-on-one, maybe.
Yep.
And they might be more truthful if, yeah, you know, that call reminded me of my kid and yeah, I'm kind of a little, can't stop thinking about it. And so, yeah, I think there is I think that's going back into the stigma thing of we don't, in my experience, like I'm not going to talk on behalf of other firefighters or paramedics, but for me, I didn't want to share or talk about those things because I was scared that I would be blackballed or targeted for elimination or
right.
You know, think, okay, well, you know, you can't do this job if you can't hack it. But you know, if a firefighter goes into an entry of a structure fire and falls through a floor and breaks their femur, no one's going to say, oh, that guy shouldn't be a firefighter. He's got weak femur. You know, yes. Yeah, your femurs are weak.
Yeah, your femurs are weak, kid. Right. Get off.
Get off. Yeah, I shouldn't be doing a firefighter. I got weak femurs. The opposite would happen. If that happened, God, that in my department and in many other departments, you know, there's a vigil outside the hospital rooms for
right
for firefighters that are injured that way. But it doesn't happen when we don't even talk about it if we fracture our mind on a call,
right?
Because exact opposite would happen. Like, oh, if you can't hack it, then get out. You know, you're not strong enough to do this job. I think it's really bizarre that there's such
disconnect
between the physical and mental injuries. But I think that's where a lot of the perceived fear and shame comes from.
Yeah.
As far as coming forward. And the truth is it's legitimate in many cases where people will come forward and they will be blackballed and they will be targeted for elimination and they will be removed from any responsibilities that they have. And that, right. that does happen.
And it's, you know, I'm sure you've seen this and felt this, but the power of the voice, the power of the experiences that you've had and that you're able to come forward and kind of not even shun, but shrug off that possibility that somebody may criticize you or somebody may say something about, oh, well, yeah, you can't hack it. How powerful has that been for you to be able to be that voice of somebody who said, you know what? Yeah, I'm struggling. I struggle and this is what I'm going to do about it. You can either join me or you can shun me, whichever you want to do. Either way, I'm good with it.
Yeah. And I think that's really important because ultimately it's saving lives.
Right.
And if you look at the statistics, yeah, the suicide rates among emergency workers are, right. It's crazy. So like, it's not something that, you know, people are making up or,
right.
You know, it is a potentially fatal condition. Yeah. And, you know, I do a memorial portrait almost every day and I don't know often how they died, but many of them are deaths by suicide and I do many of them and I know it's happening very, very often. And that's a big part of it is people don't feel safe to come forward and get the help that they need because they're capacity to understand how much trouble they're actually in has been impaired. And so that, and they don't feel that they have the resources to come forward. And maybe sometimes they're right. They don't. So what's the alternative? Well, that's by suicide.
Right.
So yeah, so it's not, no, it's not something people are making up. It's not something that's, but on the other hand of that, I don't believe that, you know, if you're going to be a firefighter, you're going to be a paramedic, you're going to get PTSD. It's inevitable. I don't believe that. I don't think that's the case. I speak very highly of my profession. I'm very proud to be a paramedic and a firefighter. I would do it all over again.
Yep.
It's the mental health aspect of it, even though that's a big center of what my world is in creating the artwork and my current ambitions to become a psychotherapist. Like that's what I'm passionate about. But yeah. I still think it is if you look at the profession as a whole, it's not the entire pie. It's a portion of the pie.
Right.
And to be aware of it and to keep that piece of that pie as small as you can through talking about it, being aware of it, being psychologically working in a psychologically safe environment where you are okay to talk about it and come forward, and having those resources available to be in a trauma-informed work environment versus being a reactionary model, like a disease model. Okay, well, this happened, now we have to do things, versus okay, well, let's try to prevent stuff from happening.
Welcome to the fire service.
Right? I know. Exactly, right? So I think it's a part. I don't want to say it's a small part, because for some people it is 100% of their pie, but I don't think it's there's a lot more to our profession that is amazing and wonderful. And I think the mental health aspect can be mitigated, just like the physical injury. Like, we want to lower our physical injury risk by all the occupational health and safety things that we do when we get new equipment. And that's really important. We need to do that. And we should just be doing the same thing with mental health. But for some reason, that's weird.
How much do you think, how much do you think, and I think you hit on huge points of, like, one is, like, it's not our whole profession, but how often do you see, like, when somebody starts talking about mental health in the first responder community, of people going overboard and going, oh my gosh, that's not everything. You know, not every call is traumatic. Not every this is that. It's almost a general reaction of, like, the sky is falling when somebody just even starts to mention it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So in my experience, because I get to travel a lot and I visit a lot of fire departments, it is definitely an important issue, but it's not the only issue.
Right.
And I think for some people, you know, if mental health isn't the biggest thing in your life, then there's something wrong. Then you don't support mental health. Like, I put on a conference every year. I put on a post-traumatic growth conference every year where our peers come and talk about their recovery and amazing things they're doing because of their trauma. And we do sell out every year, but there's a lot of friends that I have that don't go. And I'm like, okay, well, why aren't you coming to my conference? Why isn't this important to you? What's wrong with you? I don't feel that way at all. Oh, it's like, huge. Well, that's not a, it's the same. Like, if there was a tactical rope conference, and I'm horrible with ropes and knots. Like, although I probably should go to that seminar, but I don't, because it's just not something I'm interested in. But it doesn't, it's okay. It's okay that I'm not interested in it. I'm competent, of course, in doing that kind of stuff, but, and I'm aware of it. But yeah, I don't.
It's not a have to all the time.
It's not a have to. And I feel that that's kind of where we are now, where, well, if this isn't an important issue to you and you're not putting 100% of your effort into it and you're not doing all this stuff, then you're a bad person. No, not at all. I don't feel that way at all. And it does affect some of us more than others.
Yeah.
And that's, I don't paint a big brush over anything, but, that might be a controversial topic too, but
I like what you said, because I think it's so powerful for people to understand and hear at the same point that, it's not always going to be right in the forefront of your mind, but at the same time, like you said before, I always love to mention this too, is like having tools in your toolkit, not waiting until the last minute, is so critical with this. Because can it touch you in some way, shape, or form throughout your career? Oh yeah. I mean, I've been in it for 24 years. You were in 20, and for most of my career, that stuff didn't exist.
Yeah.
And it's so powerful what you're doing. What is that next iteration for you look like? What is the next thing that you're looking at doing to create that impact?
Well, it's funny you say that, because just yesterday I'm in Canada. So the Canadian Revenue Agency gave us charitable status for the foundation I formed.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So we have the Recovery and Resiliency Foundation is now a charitable organization. I actually just launched all the social media stuff today and the website.
Oh, fantastic.
And yeah, I'm really excited about that. So we're going to help emergency workers get the treatment that they need, because a lot of times you don't know.
Yep.
What you're gonna, and it's not only talk therapy. It's not always psychotherapy. But if that is the case, we're going to make sure we set them up with culturally aware therapists, yep, that know what our culture is like. But it might also be, you know, equine therapy, or it might be, you know, yoga. It might be, you know, camping. It might be being out in nature. It might be, depending on what their interests are, we can help them in their impaired state, potentially, to get them the help that they need. So that's the first thing we're going to do. The second thing is that we're going to pay for it if they don't have the resources to do that, or if they don't want to use their EAP program because they're worried about the stigma that's attached to it, then right, we will pay for that therapy. So we'll pay for the psychotherapy through vetted therapists that are trauma, like are informed of the culture, and pay for their other form of therapy that they want or that they think they would gel with. And then the third thing we're going to do with the foundation is do symposiums, which I was doing anyways, which are educational symposiums on mental health and post-traumatic growth, and where I invite my friends that come in and experts and talk about recovery and resiliency. And so that's what we're going to do. So I'm really excited about that. And we're probably going to get that. Our first focus right now is, of course, going to be fundraising so we can pay for everything. But now that we have our charitable status, I'm hoping that we'll be supported.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Well, congratulations on that. Yeah. Make sure you go to dansunphotos.com, or you can also go to recoveryandresiliencyfoundation.com to find out more. Thank you so much for joining me today, but you're not done yet. I got three questions for you. Ready?
Okay.
All right. The first question is, if you could go back to your 18-year-old self and give yourself one piece of advice, what would that be?
Just stay on track. I don't regret anything that I did since I was 18. Love I'd be it. Like, yeah, you just keep doing what you're doing. I wouldn't change. I wouldn't change anything at all.
I love it. I love it. All right. So the second one is if you could give people two habits to incorporate into their daily life to deal with their struggles and their challenges to continue to live life forward, what would those two things be?
Two habits. Habits. Because that could be a whole other topic, Rob. On
positive
habits, right?
I love it.
Incorporate. Have a habit of incorporating some type of self care, whether that being, you know, going for a walk or whatever self-care looks like to you, make that a habit, and educate yourself.
Yeah.
Continuing to educate through watching seminars on YouTube or reading books on self-care. And I think those are two habits that I think would really benefit and building your mental health jump kit.
Love it. Love it. All right. This last one's going to be fun. If you could have coffee at a firehouse table, so in other words, all conversations are on the table, with three people, deceased or alive, who would those three be?
Oh, that's a good question. First one would probably be Francisco de Goya, who's a Spanish artist.
Okay.
Who did, his story is really interesting. He did this black series of these really dark, messed up artwork.
Really?
And that's how he portrayed, it's kind of how he expressed the emotions and feelings that he was having.
Wow.
So I'd really like to get into that guy's brain, of what his motivations and how that artistic process happened for him. That's one. Two would be my dad, who recently died, who had a stroke when I was 17. So I'd love to have a conversation with him.
Yeah.
While he was still able to talk, that'd be very interesting. I'd love that. Wow. And the third one, God, I'm picking all these dead people. because you know, those, if I have a wish, like anyone that's alive, I could potentially still
have a communication.
So yeah. I'm going to pick dead people. And let's see, the third one would probably be, that's a good one. That's a good question. thinking of someone that's like really authentic and someone that really lived their life, with purpose.
Right. It's always a hard one.
This is going to be really weird because this just came into my head. This is going to be totally opposite. I don't know how people are going to take this, but I just finished reading to Arnold Schwarzenegger's book. And yes. I specifically got it on audiobook because he narrates it himself. Oh, and it was just so entertaining. It was just so entertaining just to listen to him narrate his own book.
Yeah.
So I know this, I went from someone who's dead that lived their life with meaning and purpose to going to Arnold Schwarzenegger. However,
I watched that and that was amazing.
It was really cool. So yeah, I think to have those three people in a room at a fire hall having coffee.
That'd be really interesting. That's perfect. I love it. I love it. Well, that's a perfect way to end it. So thank you so much for joining me today. It's been just an honor to have you on.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thanks for asking me on your show. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks for listening and supporting the Forged in the Fires podcast with Fireman Rob. Remember, don't forget to like and subscribe to this podcast. And please share this episode with a friend or family member. To find out more about Fireman Rob, or if you have a question, go to www.firemanrob.com. Until next time, live your life forged in the fires.